You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Welcome back, friends. Please make sure your pod seats and tray tables are in their upright and locked positions. The airlock has been sealed and docking clamps have been released for an on-time departure to the Functional Nerdverse. Patrick, so I know that you have not been a D&D player for some time. You're more of a Pathfinder dude.
I still do 5e every other Sunday.
Well, I mean, like, okay, fine. Yeah, so on Giles's account.
Yes.
So what was your entry Dungeons & Dragons world? Like?
The Red Box.
Okay, yeah, okay.
So two things. I was handed the Red Box and the original little pamphlet rules by my friend Tom in high school. And he said, I want to play this game. I don't understand how to run it. You're smart. Figure it out and run the game for us.
Oh, so you get homework. Yeah.
Yes. And so I did. And then we started playing Dungeons & Dragons at the library at Fresno High School.
Nice. I had like the Red Box and the Green Box and whatnot because my mom found them at like resale shops and library sales and things like that. Like never, they were always like incomplete bits and things, but I never actually played or DM'd any of that stuff. I didn't have an opportunity to until much, much later. I was just starting high school. And for me, it was Faerun. It was Forgotten Realms.
We never did Forgotten Realms.
Yeah. See, I think that's it's a gateway for lots of people. But when I finally had money of my own and had the opportunity to buy sets for Worlds, I bought two because they were so different from Faerun. And I was like, I love the vibes on this. I want to explore them more. And my brother went and he bought two. He bought Planescape and Spelljammer, which, you know, kind of interesting combo. Yep. And I bought Dark Sun and Ravenloft.
There's the connection.
This is how we're getting to lots of things, not least of which, of course, is Delilah Dawson, who's here for actually tons of things. But one of them, at least recently, that's already out in the universe of 2025 is The Heir of Strahd, which is a Ravenloft tie-in novel. So welcome aboard, Delilah. It's so lovely to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh my gosh. So, okay.
So hold on. Yeah. So Tracy liked a vampire thing. That seems very on brand for you.
Yes, it is. It's, yeah.
Yeah.
Are on brand for me or on brand for Delilah? Or
on
yes.
brand for you, okay. Tracy.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
I mean, my first book series was vampire romance. So I've.
Yes.
I'm old school in this realm.
Yeah. You're just stretching muscles, you know. The sort of familiar space to be. My first Dungeons and Dragons tie-in novel actually was I, Strahd by P.N. Elrod. So that was my sort of baby journey there. So, okay. Given your background and writing, it's not hard for me to understand why the world of the people of Hasbro would reach out to you and say, we would want you for this project. But what made you say, actually, yeah, this is something I want to spend some time on. This could be fun.
Well, you know, my D&D origin story is that I was too nerdy to have people to actually play the games with. So I just bought the manuals at the used bookstore and read them like they were encyclopedias.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, I've never actually, like, I hadn't actually played the game in the normal way. I had just, like, read them obsessively like I would an animal encyclopedia during a hyperfixation.
Right.
But, you know, reading the Curse of Strahd module, like, it's so rich and so interesting. And you start to realize that, like, in any given game, you're barely scratching the surface of every possible interaction you could have. So, when they came to me and it, you know, the editors at Penguin Random House Worlds, who are the same editors for Star Wars and Minecraft and Stranger Things, other things I've written, are the contact position. When they came to me and brought up Ravenloft, it was just right in my sweet spot because I've got the vampire horror creepy side. And then I've also got the kind of whimsical fun side. Like my earliest website is Whimsy Dark because everything I do is on kind of the scale between the two. So it was a perfect fit. And I was so excited.
But I think that the setup for the novel really leans into your ability to kind of work those polarities too, because we have, of course, Ravenloft, for those who might not know, one of the I don't know, gimmicks, let's say, of Ravenloft is that there are these mists that surround its various provinces, and that beings come out of the mists that have been sort of drawn there from other worlds. It's a little bit like falling into the Upside Down in a way. And so we have this party of adventurers that have been drawn into the world of Barovia, the province that Strahd has dominion over. And they are just not ready for this place. And I think that creates that opportunity for you to kind of play with how does the whimsical survive or thrive, or at least just not immediately get itself killed off.
For a known franchise, one of my goals is for the book to be, you know, not a gate but a door to welcome in new people who, you know, might not have played before or who are not familiar, so that they can learn with the characters and better immerse in the world, and then, you know, maybe that will make them feel more comfortable, whether it's reading more Dungeons and Dragons novels or starting a game with some friends. But at the same time, I want to do honor to the existing canon. Like, you know, I've read the old Christie Golden books, you know, Vampire in the Mist and River Dancer, and I've read the Eye Strahd, like, and it's important to, you know, maintain the canon aspects of Strahd. Like, he's not going to be a sparkly Edward vampire. Strahd is Strahd. He is, you know, the demigod of his world. And so the book is still aligned with Curse of Strahd, where if you unfold your map, you can trace their way through the castle. I had to add a bedroom because for a big castle, there's only like two beds in the whole thing. So you have to add. Let's pretend there's a bedroom.
Not enough beds is a different genre trope. That's what, yeah.
It is. But so, yeah. So, you know, people who have played the game will find many things familiar and be like, oh, yeah, I remember that trap door. I remember this guy or that guy. People who haven't read it will hopefully learn with the characters who we had to kind of start them. Like, they couldn't start at level one. They had to start at like a two or a three. Otherwise, they'd just get creamed.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
But this is true even now. Like, you don't want to start at level one. You're gonna die. You're gonna die a lot.
Yeah.
I don't think as a gamer I've ever started as a level one in a maybe in like a one shot. Like the library kids department is like some librarian is hosting like a one shot 3 hour thing on a Sunday for kids, and they get like pre generated characters.
There's a thing because it for the players it's like things start getting really cool and fun at level three. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people will just skip one and two because it can be brutal. It can be so brutal, especially in Pathfinder now with the remaster, but also in 5e. Like, it can just be so brutal on those low level characters that a lot of GMs will, you know, try to go up a little higher.
Well, part of the problem in Ravenloft is that the characters who arrive there via the mists don't know what genre they're in. They don't know where they are, but they think they're, you know, just in like a everyday, you know, comedy drama world. They don't realize that they're in the horror world. And some of them, it takes them a while to understand that.
Which in and of itself is its own kind of fun experience, because you see these characters who, if they were only in the context that they do understand, they might be more prepared, more sure-footed, more confident, you know, less, you know, feckless, all these things. And instead, because they don't know what genre they're in, they're kind of playing it wrong, which also creates all these cool narrative opportunities for you to kind of work in things that if everyone knew from jump they were in a horror story, we would be doing the equivalent of being like, don't go into the basement to check the circuit breaker. Like, we don't have to have those moments of frustration as readers with the text, because you're operating with this sense of like, no, I've made that stuff, that kind of world equivalent stuff. It's fair game now, because they really don't know.
They never had a session zero.
You have to kind of call it out as well, so that the reader knows that they're on it too. Like, I've got a paladin in here who was raised in kind of a cult compound. So although she has the powers of a paladin and the faith and the armor, she hasn't necessarily faced a lot of things. And so, you know, she meets a canon character later on who's like, you're a paladin. Were you not sensing for evil? And she's like, no, why would I? It's like, oh my God, there's like dudes everywhere. But like, she's never encountered evil monsters, so it doesn't occur to her like, I wonder.
That's a thing I can do? Like, there's evil? Like, for real? Hilarious. Oh my gosh. I do love that there's that tie in the map of the module itself and in the book too, because it seems like it's on the one hand sort of like rewarding people who are familiar with that core material for their familiarity without giving away too much. That classic Easter egg kind of move.
Yeah, we're not going to tell you how to kill Strahd.
No, that's a plot thing right there. But also it's like, it becomes a little bit of bait to be like, do you want to try something like this? Well, boy, howdy, guess what? You can go hear your very own self.
Well, and all of these characters actually have character sheets and stats. Like if someone wanted to play these specific characters, like I can just, you know, put up screenshots of their stats and be like, God go with you.
So I'm curious about that. Sorry, Tracy, but I'm curious. Like, I know you just went to Gen Con. Has anybody tried to use your book as a campaign setting? Like, have they done that? Like, have they tried to run people through your book? Did anybody come up to you?
If they have, I haven't heard about it, but I would love to. I can't imagine how much fun it would be to play Chivarion.
That would be awesome.
It would be a delight. Like, it's one of those things where I wish that we did more like live author D&D at cons. We used to do it a little bit. It was usually called All Bards, and we were all bards and we were all idiots. But it would be a lot of fun to see people play acting these characters.
So the character sheets, are they things that you drew up, that you worked with your editors on? Yes, and both, or?
I worked on the character party composition with them, you know, because we wanted to make sure we had a good mix, and they wanted to see a lot of kind of like non-human and typically negatively coded characters being used in ways that were unexpected, which I'm totally down for. But once we'd said like, you know, okay, we're going to have a nerdy orc wizard, and we're going to have an angry tiefling paladin, and we're going to have like a shy kinku cleric. Like once we had that, I came up with the backstories and I, you know, gave them their stats and chose their spells, that sort of thing.
That is so cool. I do love the particular combination of character types and character like races, species, and so on, because it feels like you've made some of the least obvious pairings here. And that's part of what makes it feel more real, more like we're actually exploring the variety of what an RPG setting can offer for people who are playing it, but should still be present in this, like the bones of the story itself.
Yeah, that's part of the fun of it is, you know, with any book, you're trying to give the reader something familiar enough that they feel comfortable and yet something so new that they feel kind of delighted, like they haven't seen it before.
Yeah, like I don't think I've ever thought of a drow barbarian before. Like, I don't think that those are two words that ever went and now kiss in my
head. Yeah, that was, I mean, he's I think if you follow my Instagram where I was doing a lot of quotes, like he's just my favorite and he can't get around that. I actually commissioned artist Jake Bartok to do a little, I'm going to do print stickers of Chivarion and Murder. So I'm going to have those, you know, hopefully by BuboniCon, DragonCon, and New York Comic Con to give out.
Nice.
That's awesome. That is super cool. So I did tease kind of at the start that there are many things going on in the Dawsonverse, as it were. And you've listed many of them to us, at least in Green Room before we got started here. But like, holy cow, this is really just the tip of the iceberg for 2025, yeah?
Yeah, I've got 4 books out this year. So, you know, I had this one come out in May. My next one came out on Tuesday. It's a middle grade horror called Ride or Die. It is the third of my middle grade horrors. And it's about an abandoned amusement park and a nerdy girl who just wants to be cool for one night and is willing to do anything to be cool for one night. And then bad things happen. Then I've got 2 more in September. The first one is called House of Idol. It is a rock star cult horror novel. Basically, like, we know that Jared Leto runs a cult, but what if it was a murder cult? And that one's super fun. They just sent me the live, you know, the actual books, and it's got, I wrote liner notes. So, like, every chapter heading has a little CD case with the album and the lyrics to the song and
oh
a different little, like, you know, image on it. And it's a beautiful book. And my husband wrote a song to go with it. So I'm super excited about that one just because it's so fun. And we have like guitar picks as swag. Like it's
funny, cool.
Rockstar book. It's so fun.
How do I get a guitar pick?
You gotta see me somewhere. You gotta run into me somewhere.
I have to leave my house?
You do.
I did that last year.
Yeah.
It has to happen every now and then. And then the last one is out September 16th. It's called Marvel, Thor and Loki, Epic Tales from Marvel and Mythology. And it is a really interesting book. It's a beautiful book with full illustrations by Gabrielle H. Walta. But it is about Thor and Loki in the role of the bard telling the Norse mythology stories to the Avengers, as well as some classic Marvel stories about Thor and Loki told in that same classic bardic style.
So is that a anthology that you're part of then?
Or? Nope, it's just me. I did the whole thing.
Oh, wow.
It was definitely different writing it. I write most of my books front to back, like carrying laundry from the dryer to the bed where you're just, I gotta go, get out of my way, trip on the cat, drop the sock, I don't care, gotta get done. Whereas writing this book was more like every day I had the homework of my homework today is to take this myth and put it through, you know, the Thor or Loki grinder and produce, you know, a solid chapter of a retelling of the story while having to filter it through four or five different sources because there is no one Norse mythology Bible. It's all piecemeal put together because it's such an oral tradition.
Wow. So that's a host of different projects to have had. And of course, given how publishing works, like timelines are weird, and some of these were coming into being simultaneously and some of these were not, and so on. But the thing that I guess that interests me most is the way that involves you just having to sort of flip some switches in your head. So like, for instance, like let's imagine a day of Delilah doing work on a book. Is it all going to be the same book, or are we going to like do one thing in the AM or something different after lunch, or how does...
Given my druthers, I only work on one project at a time. Every now and then I'll have to, you know, like right now I'm first drafting a new book, a new YA book. And so if on Monday, you know, an editor sent me a draft and said, you know, here's your revision, we need this by 3 weeks, then I would halt, you know, the book I'm writing, kick out the revision because people are waiting on that and it's sold and people's, you know, livelihoods are depending on it. And I have a deadline and I would finish that and then send it off and then go back to my original project. But I would find it very challenging to say, you know, edit one project in the morning and write a different one in the afternoon, which I would have to do because editing uses a lot more brain cells. And I have done that before, but I don't love it because at the end of the day, I don't have any words left and I'm real stupid. And my family will be like, what's wrong with you? But I'll be like, no can work. I don't know. No, I don't know.
Point and grunt.
Cereal. That's all I got.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That thing right there, put some food in front of me. Oh, I couldn't even, I could hardly imagine. And it's also it's a combination of sort of having to toggle back and forth between being at your liberty as the up and down creator of this thing in its entirety and working within the expectations and requests that are made of you when you're in an IP universe and there's some kind of tie-in operating there. And so that, I imagine, also has to really kind of tweak your brain and your preparation in a variety of ways.
Well, the IP process starts with pitching and then honing a pitch back and forth and then turning that pitch into an outline and then going back and forth with the outline. So it's more of a, you know, I do something and then I send it over to the editors and it's out of my hands. Well, you know, it takes me 2 hours to do and then it takes them a week to a month to figure out their next step. So I just kind of do it real quick and toss it away. But once we've honed an outline and we've all agreed on that and I'm writing on my own, it's pretty much the same process as writing one of my own books. You know, there are some more guide rails if you can and you can't do this. Depending on which franchise it is, you might have, you know, taller guide rails versus, you know, a very small speed bump in the road. For example, Star Wars, you know, there's a lot of guide rails. I can't just use any character or any ship or any planet because other things are happening. And we have a very carefully plotted and detailed timeline physically and spatially. On the other hand, I've worked with other IP, you know, like X-Files. It was a speed, you know, the only thing I couldn't do was let Skulder and Mully get physical or romantic. writing Adventure Time, the only real rule at that time was that you couldn't cross the Finn and Jake world with the Fiona and Cake world. And then you get to something like Firefly with my graphic novel, The Sting, where Joss Whedon is still involved. Like, he has read the script and had thoughts. Like, he is still the person who invented it, is not going to let you, you know, treat his baby badly, basically. So
he's
got to learn the rules and abide by them. But once I'm drafting, it's still that same, you know, running across the room with hot laundry.
So, okay. May we ask where are we in the hot laundry process right now with Shannara, which, by the way, congratulations.
Thank you.
For those people who don't know what I'm referencing here, it's been a couple of months, I think, since you announced this.
Yeah, but that was at Emerald City Comic Con.
Yeah. So that's been a couple of months back. But Delilah has been tapped to sort of step into this short sort of Shannara universe. You'll be writing those books here. So, all right. So
And Terry Brooks is retiring completely, or?
He's just going to do whatever he wants.
Okay.
He doesn't care to be, he doesn't want people having the expectations of him, basically. So if he wants to write a book, he'll write a book, but it's not one that's contracted that his editor is staring at him and looking at her watch.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Okay.
So I know he still has some writing project he's working on, but for Shannara, for what comes next, you know, this one's me, and hopefully I'll get to, he would like me to do more. Hopefully Delray will as well. Cause I really like working with Terry and with his our editor, Anne.
Yeah.
But so that one, it was similar, you know, where we worked through an outline. I read all of the materials that Terry had amassed and collected for the book. And it's kind of different in that Shannara is one of those worlds, kind of like Star Wars, where we didn't start at the beginning and go straight through to the end. We kind of started in the middle, and then we jump back here, then we jump forward in time, then we jump backwards. So I'm basically writing about, like, Shannara Jesus, Gallifile, the first druid. And most of his stories are apocryphal, which is great because it's like kind of like King Arthur. Like, we think we know what happened. We don't know for sure. Some of the things, you know, like, we're extrapolating from what one dude said or from looking at the ruins. So I'm, you know, working with Terry and with the various Wikipedias and then with my good old fashioned World of Shannara tome to make sure that we're not, you know, changing what's been said, but also, you know, taking apocryphal things and hammering them out into more concrete ways. The first draft is finished. Terry likes it a lot. I have not heard, his editor has read 10,000 words of it and liked that a lot, but she hasn't read the whole thing. And I'm sure I will get an edit letter one day that, you know, I've been writing, I think this is my 13th year, maybe 2012 was my first book. And I think every time I turn in a draft, I'll be like, maybe this will be the time it's perfect. And there's always going to be an edit letter, I think, no matter how far along I get. And that's probably good. I think we know what happens when authors get to the point where no one can tell them no. But I will get an edit letter, and then I will stop whatever I'm doing and I will fix it.
Now,
because I don't want to disappoint Uncle Terry.
It's been a hot minute for me. I read, like, the original books, and then probably around the time you started writing, like, he was releasing new trilogies. And I remember reading those. But isn't the whole thing about that world is that it's post-apocalyptic? Like, there's, like, a thing that kind of resets everything, and then people start...
Yeah, it's basically our world, and it mostly takes place in what would have been the Pacific Northwest. But it's like there was a big human war where our machines and science that we created blew everything up, and everything kind of reset to where the remaining humans had to go into hiding, and lots of them were kind of mutated into things that resemble trolls and gnomes. The elves were here all along, though, and were always magic. It's this world that feels, you know, Tolkien-esque and fantasy level. But if you read it carefully, you know, like, you're in the background of a destroyed Seattle.
And yeah.
I watched the Amazon show, and you can see it where you're like, oh, yeah, there's that. They really brought out that part of it.
That's right. There was an Amazon show.
It was little baby Austin Butler.
I vaguely remember that.
Yep. MTV did it.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. It's definitely been a hot minute since then.
Yeah, that one flew entirely under my radar, which also should surprise no one because bad at TV. But
yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. I wonder if it's still on there.
You can buy it on Amazon. Yeah.
Interesting.
I think once they got their hooks in, they don't let go. I think they're gonna say, you know, never mind.
You would think after Elvis, they would have, like, reissued it.
One cannot begin to comprehend what happens at the streamers these days.
It is a crazy time. Yeah.
So, all right, you did Emerald City Comic Con. You were just at Gen Con.
Yeah.
So where else are you headed for 2025 here?
Yeah, I've got BubonaCon next in New Mexico, which I'm very excited about because I've never been to New Mexico before.
Good food. Really good food.
I have a gluten allergy, so it's all predicated on that, but I can usually get by on Mexican, so should do pretty well with my corn tortillas.
Yeah.
The inferior tortilla, but still a tortilla nonetheless. Then we've got Dragon Con, which is my home con, and I'm up for a Dragon Award again this year, which is very exciting for it will only hurt for a moment. But I'm also up against Stephen Graham Jones and Chuck Tingle, so I don't think I have great odds, but I'll still be there to cheer on whoever wins. And then we've got New York Comic Con in October with a couple of events around October because spooky season. I'll be doing something at Tomorrow Bookstore in Indianapolis with CJ Lead, and I'll be doing something at Gibson's Bookstore in New Hampshire with CJ and also Clay McCloud Chapman, which will be nice because I hear he puts on a great show. And then Louisiana Book Festival. Twin Cities Comic Con in November.
Holy crap. And then you still write. I just don't.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I write on trips. Airport's a great place to write. It's a liminal space. Nobody messes with you.
Was this your first Gen Con?
No, my first Gen Con was in 2015 when the Writer Symposium was just double-barreled stacked. And that's actually, that Gen Con is the reason I have a comics career. Because I was asked at the last minute to be on a panel called How to Write Comics for Women that they only realized that morning was five white guys.
Oh my God.
So I'd only written 12 pages of free comics, but they needed a girl. So I was on that panel and it went so badly that the Mary Sue did an extensive article on it. And because of that, an editor at Boom Studios invited me to pitch him. And that's the comic that became Lady Castle.
Nice.
So I hold Gen Con dear in my heart.
That's one of my favorite things that went very wrong that actually turned out very right. Stories I've heard in a minute.
Yeah.
I had a similar experience, except without any of the success afterwards. But myself, Chuck Wendig, and I believe Jim Hines were put on a panel at a writer's thing and about women's experiences in writing. And then there's two women there. And we're just sitting there and we're like, why don't you just talk for like the next hour? We'll just sit here. Like, because it just seems so silly that we were put on this thing. I don't know. Sometimes I feel bad for programming people because they I just feel bad.
You know, that's so I've known Terry Brooks for a long time, I think since at least 2016 or 2017. But a panel that we were on together once, and I believe Seattle, it was, you know, writing strong female characters in fantasy. And it was like, you know, two women and three men. And we get to Terry and he says, I'm Terry Brooks. I wrote Shannara and I'm not a woman. So I'm going to sit back and listen.
Attaboy, Terry.
And every time it came again, he'd go pass, ask one of the women. And then, you know, you get to the Q&A, and I'm Mr. Brooks and Elfstones. And he's like, I'm going to pass that on to the women. Like, it was the most gentlemanly, it was a classy move.
That's awesome.
The classic curmudgeon is a nice move. Yeah.
He was at Denver Comic Con when it was still called Denver Comic Con.
God, I miss Denver Comic Con. That was such a good con.
It's still there. It's just a different name.
Well, from my understanding, you know, the publishers don't go. I don't think I know any writers who go. Like, it just isn't.
The writers' tracks are not a focus. I'm trying to be very diplomatic. Writers are not a focus there. They're trying to be more of a media thing, but, I forget what it's called now. Is it Pop Culture Con, or maybe they even changed that now. It's something else. It's,
Lila doesn't get to go see the bear anymore.
Well, anyway, he was there and Tattered Cover was there, and Tattered Cover made a huge, big deal out of it. Like, they had like this whole space on the floor, that was just like, they built a pop-up bookstore. And did events with Terry Brooks when he was there, which I thought was very, very cool. Yeah.
That is super cool.
I'm trying to remember what the name of Fan Expo. Is it Fan Expo? Is that what it's called now?
I don't know, man.
Giles and them just went and I cannot remember for the life of me what it's called. I don't go anymore because I feel like they treat writers like shit. So I don't go.
Yeah. If you're not going to prioritize writers, that's not a place where I feel welcome.
No.
So.
Yeah, no.
Doesn't seem like you're having any trouble finding other places that can be good.
But I miss Denver. That was a great con.
Yeah.
And a fun city. And I need to see Meow Wolf.
Oh, I totally went to Meow Wolf.
She did. Yeah, she could tell. Yeah, a couple. So
there's like a whole Meow Wolf pre-Meow Wolf story having to do with me being directionally challenged vis-a-vis meeting up with Patrick in Denver for food. But yeah, went to Meow Wolf with my family, and one of the family members who was with us is a guy. He's one of the board members for Arlington, Virginia's Arts Council, and he's worked for the Smithsonian for years, and he's one of my husband's uncles. And it was absolutely the right crowd to go see Meow Wolf in. And for those people who are listening right now and they're like, are they saying meow plus wolf? And yes, that's what we're saying. and they're like, what is that? And the answer is, I don't know. I was there and I don't know what it was. It is not an art gallery. It's not an amusement park. It's not a museum. It's kind of a performance art thing, but it's also like, I don't know. It's sort of like, what if the Fifth Element were a play place and also an artist collective at the same time?
Yeah. For Patrick, it's a potential overstimulation issue.
Oh yeah. I was there for 2.5 hours before I was like, I'm tapping out. I'm going downstairs to the cafe and I'm going to just sit there. And the rest of the family did stuff for like another whole hour after that.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of interactive theater. Like, I think I went to sleep no more 6 or 7 times, and I did Life or Trust, and very eager to do something Meow Wolfy, but everything they do is like 3 to 4 hours away. Like, nothing is, it is not convenient, and it is not in the South. Although I did do a really cool one in Tampa that I think was inspired by it, called the Mermaid Star Hotel. That was really cool. But yeah, I'm all for these, you know, interactive art installations with a theatrical element.
Well, while we're on this kick of recommending things that we think are super cool, this sounds to me like Picks of the Week time.
It does sound like Picks time. We'll get to Picks of the Week in just a second. I wanted to take a moment to say it's been 3 years. 3 years since anyone has given us a star or a review on Apple Podcasts. And that's just insane. So, if you like what we do, please take a couple of minutes, go over to Apple Podcasts and give us a star and maybe some kind of kind words, like a review. And if you don't use Apple Podcasts, no worries. Take those same couple of minutes to give us a star and some kind words on your favorite podcast catcher or platform, whatever that may be. It really does help. Now, back to what you really wanted to hear. Picks of the week.
Patrick, what's your pick for this week?
My pick shouldn't surprise anyone, although it's a little late, but I've had so many things to pick that I just had to prioritize. Star Trek Strange New Worlds is back. And I am, again, loving the season. They just had one, as of this recording, one of the best episodes, I think, so far. They where like there's an away team and they have to go into a structure, and then, you know, shenanigans happen. And I enjoyed the hell out of that episode. I continue to love the writing. I continue to love all the actors and the characters and how they're kind of bringing them out. And yeah, Strange New Worlds. I'm happy that they're getting 2 more seasons. So they're going to get a full 5, I believe, before they're being canceled. So far, they haven't been canceled for poking fun at any current administration people like some other Paramount/CBS properties have. Stephen Colbert.
Last night too? Oh, sorry, thinking South Park.
No. I was thinking it's just funny that you know, Colbert gets canceled, and then South Park gets $1.5 billion to continue, and they immediately start in, and the response is, "Well, I hear they're on their last legs. Like, they're not." Yeah, like they're not doing well in the ratings or anything, and like no one's watching them. $1.5 billion. I think it's a thing. So, yeah. Anyway, Strange New Worlds. I love it. You know, I love Star Trek anyway. So, yeah, go watch Strange New Worlds.
Fantastic. So, Delilah, what has been bringing you joy?
I'm going to talk about more of a concept in two distinct ways, which is shoving it to late stage capitalism. I recently learned that if you have a library card to your basic whatever your neighborhood library is, you can use an app called Libby, L-I-B-B-Y. You go to this app, you give it your library card number, and it says, cool, you're a library member. And suddenly you can read any book on an ebook or listen to the audiobook for free, just like you're checking it out from a library. You have 14 or 15 days. Anyway, I went from the usual paid subscription for audiobooks, because I listen to audiobooks. I am in my late 40s and I have to go for power walks or I die. So I do a lot of power walking and I do cleaning and I do weightlifting, and like it gets kind of expensive with the audiobooks, and now I can rent them. And when you do this, it still contributes to the author's bottom line. Like a certain amount of money is paid to them and their royalties whenever you listen to their book. So it's not like you're shoving it to authors. This isn't pirating. It is as legitimate as renting it from the library. Love this concept. So happy with it. If you don't like the audiobook, you return it like a library book and get a new one. You don't go, oh, well, that's my $15 credit for the month. So yeah, super love Libby. Big fan of it. And I had a little ADHD problem with executive function getting it. And then once I did it, it was so easy. It was like 15 seconds. You literally just look at your library card and type in numbers. Nice. And my other aspect of this is I'm not liking the clothes in stores these days. I don't want to contribute to fast fashion. And I am, you know, again, like the current styles are not, you know, ideal for my body and my taste. And I was getting really frustrated. And then I realized that I can look at any item of clothing in my closet that I love, and I can find it being resold somewhere online. You're going to want to look at Mercari, M-E-R-C-A-R-I, Poshmark, eBay, or Depop. But like my favorite shirts is a t-shirt by James Purse that I bought at TJ Maxx for $9. If I bought it new from Nordstrom, it's a $65 t-shirt. I buy every single one that comes up for under 20 bucks online because I love this t-shirt more than any other t-shirt. So these are my two favorite things that I am doing to kind of, it feels like I'm doing a good thing for the earth because I'm not conspicuously consuming, but it's also like, oh, I can actually get the things I want, under strictures that I'm comfortable with. And I'll do one more thing, which is a book that I found, which is The Paleontologist by Luc Dumas. I was on him with a panel recently at San Diego Comic-Con, great guy. But I basically got the audiobook because it was like a dinosaur being haunted by dinosaurs in a natural history museum. And I was like, nobody can pull that off. You're not going to scare me with that. How are you going to pull that off? He pulls it off. I was so impressed. So yeah, definitely give The Paleontologist, if you like dinosaurs and like things being named accurately and like actual attention to detail in that realm, great book.
That's fantastic. Oh, wow. So you gave us a lot of great stuff to work with.
I get real excited about stuff.
Yeah.
In my newsletter, I have a thing called Three Good Things where I just talk about three. And every month I'm like, there's so many good things.
Three is too few. So we've covered how to get off your streaming services there. We've covered like how to get off of fast fashion. We've got a cool audiobook. We've got a cool TV show. And I'm going to round it out with a game. It took a little while to come in the mail. Husbeast's birthday is a July birthday, and we are recording now in August, so it came a little bit later than I wanted it to, but a game that was just so deeply Husbeast-coded, I found, had really good reviews. I was like, oh, he's really going to like this game a lot, and I might like it too. And so I ordered a copy of it. We played it last night with one of our gaming hobo friends who came over, and two big thumbs up to Deep Regrets. So Deep Regrets is a game about fishing. The tagline for it is a game about fishing progressively more horrifying things out of the ocean. And so if you're thinking to yourself, who would want to do this? The answer is me. I want to do this. So Deep Regrets is very Lovecraftian coded. Without explicitly using the names of anything from the Lovecraft verse. And the idea is you are a fisher person who's, fishing some particularly sketch waters here, and you need money and you need to survive. And so you're going to keep going deeper and deeper into these waters and fishing out more and more what the fuck are these things. Some of which may make you crazy, or you could eat them, which might give you some power-ups, but also make you a little crazier. It's actually deeply hilarious. The art is exactly that perfect line between being distressing and amusing. Every character has the sort of version of themselves that you can play, where there's a guy named Bert who just like looks like the classic Gorton's fisherman thing with the hat and stuff, right? But if you flip it over, Bert becomes Burb. And is just like a fish dude who's just like clearly seen too much and is, you know, kind of got the Innsmouth look going on. It is just deeply fun and funny. It plays about 30 minutes per player-ish, so depending on how many folks you want to get to the table. It has a co-op mode, a solo mode, and a competitive mode, so it offers quite a lot of different gameplay experiences, and it can take 1 to 5 players. So if it sounds like the sort of thing where you're the kind of sicko who wants to pretend to be driven crazy as cartoon version of yourself eating weird things out of the sea, then congratulations. Deep Regrets is for you.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So before you do your wrap up stuff, Tracy, I did threaten that I was going to talk about this because I just have to. I have known Delilah for a long time, just interacted online, and I think we've met at a couple of cons once or twice. One of my favorite things that you ever did was the Tales of Pell with Kevin Hearn. And it starts with Kill the Farm Boy. I'm just curious. Like, I know that we've talked about this before, but it's been a minute. Can you just briefly tell us, like, how did that come to be? How did you guys come to do the Tales of Pell? And I think it was a trilogy, right?
It was.
Yeah.
So the Tales of Pell is kind of like a woke American version of Terry Pratchett, you know, as close as two Americans can come to even approaching that kind of humor, but God knows we tried. So Kevin and I were at a book signing in Texas with Charlene Harris and Rachel Kane, God rest her soul. And in the airport on the way back, we were told to go get barbecue, but the good barbecue place was closed. So we were at the bad barbecue place being like, this is the worst barbecue I've ever had. And he was like, buddy, got this idea for an anthology where we would take fantasy tropes and lovingly mess with them. Like, I was thinking, like, this first story could be like Kill the Farm Boy, because like the farm boy is destined for greatness and you kill him, and then like somebody else is the real story. And I was like, oh yeah, like the chainmail bikini, maybe it's on layaway. And so we just kind of started playing with it, and we tried to set it up as an anthology. We invited in some of our author friends, and then about, you know, a couple months into this process, Kevin was like, buddy, I don't like this. This isn't fun. Like, I'm herding cats. Somebody gets back to me. Like, it's, you got to find somebody to sell this to. He's like, I'm just giving up. And I was like, okay, hear me out. You and I write the book. We each write half a book and we get more profits. And so we gave it a try. So we, the first book, Kill the Farm Boy, we kind of spitballed over IM, basically. It might have even been Twitter DM back then, but just playing around with the concepts. We came up with the characters and the outline, and then we took turns writing each character. So nobody has ownership over any character. Whichever one you land on for that chapter, you write. And if somebody has like a strong idea for a chapter, it would be like, oh, buddy, I really want to do this one. Would you mind if we switch? Oh, yeah, that's great. I want to do the next one anyway. Because working with Kevin is like working with God's favorite Muppet. It's just the most pleasant, entertaining experience. So one of us would write the chapter and send it over, and then the second person would be in the comments going, oh, this is so fun, you're the best, I love this, and then fix all the mistakes while you do that. And then you'd write your chapter and send it back, and they do the same thing. So it's just you trying to make your best friend laugh while fixing each other's mistakes. And so at the end, you've got, like, the book's already been edited once. And we've tried to, you know, merge the voices, and the whole idea is that you shouldn't be able to tell who wrote what.
And oh, I couldn't.
Entirely fun. And then the second one is No Country for Old Gnomes. And we story broke that one in New Orleans on Frenchman Street, where we'd go to just a weird different bar and follow in the vibes. And so, you know, the whole book came from these different places. And then the third one is The Princess Beard. And that one, we story broke it in Seattle, which is why it has more maritime flair. We started in a tiki bar.
Well, thank God the tiki bar is open.
Yeah, it was great. That was the best experience. Kevin and I had the most fun. We would write more any day.
I love those books. I love the humor in them. And I am also an audiobook person, and I love the audiobooks for those.
Oh yes, Luke Daniels. if you like an audiobook that's acted out, Luke Daniels not only does the Tales of Pell, but also Kevin's Hounded series, the Iron Druid series, as well as his Seven Kennings series. So if you haven't checked those out, Kevin Hearn is a great writer with a wonderful backlist.
Yeah. Absolutely. Love those books. So I did have to mention that, Tracy. Sorry.
No, it's nothing to be sorry for. We managed to sneak basically two guests in on one episode. It's not a bad deal. All right. So if folks want to check out all things Delilah, this is a good year for it. Whether you're down for something that's Marvel-y or something that's D&D-y, or you want to get yourself some YA horror going on, or some MG horror going on, or damn, I'm just tired describing it. Congratulations, Delilah.
I get bored very easily.
Yeah, I guess so. You managed to keep ahead of that. So Delilah, where can people find you next?
I am Delilah S. Dawson pretty much everywhere that I am. So DelilahSDawson.com is my website. I am on Blue Sky and Threads and Instagram right now, all as Delilah S. Dawson. And I'm one of those people where a lot of people helped me out when I was coming up as a writer. I learned how to write on social media and the internet in the good old days of joy. But yeah, if you talk to me on social media, I'll talk back. Like maybe don't say, Delilah, how do I get published, because I'll be like, oh, your reaction to the test is part of the test. There is a writer's resources page on my website. Go read all of that. But like, if you have a question about any of my books, if you want a recommendation of my backlist has like 36 books in it, I'd be happy. You just tell me your favorite book and I'll recommend one for you. I also give writing advice online sometimes, but I'm you know, there and available to talk to. And then my events are also on my website, and I have a newsletter, GNU, new. I really like wildebeest. So you can sign up there. I send it out maybe once or twice a year if I'm lucky. Real bad at it.
Thanks so much, Delilah.
Thank you all so much for having me.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of The Functional Nerds. We really appreciate it. If you liked this episode, or really any of our episodes, please consider backing us over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. You can get access to some cool stuff and help us to keep the lights on. You can also show your support by mentioning us and sharing any of our episodes on your own social channels to help boost the signal. Trust me, that can be huge.
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy, who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake, Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, hey, I really love what you do, I'm like, I'm sorry, do you know who I, like, I think you have me confused with someone else.
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.